This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After the Pulse nightclub shooting, 60 businesses around the club were forced to shut their doors for more than a week as the FBI taped off the street. Businesses picking up again, even as mourners and well-wishers continue to stop by the impromptu memorial outside the nightclub to leave flowers, messages and balloons. But that week of lost revenue had a big impact on small businesses along that stretch of Orange Avenue. Jonathan Toothman owns Innovative Electronics, which is right across the street from Pulse.
This is a Radio Shack franchise, established initially back in 70. I've been in the same family the entire time. And Orange Avenue, 2001, directly across the street from Pulse.
And just to paint a picture for our listeners, you look out your nice bay windows here, and what do you see?
Well, I see Pulse is directly across the street. And, you know, the schedules that they operate and we operate on are entirely different. So, you know, when we go about our business on a daily basis, we see nothing going on over there. And I'm sure from their perspective, they see nothing going on over here. Their business is a nightclub opening at 9 and really starting to happen around midnight or 2 a.m., whereas we're closed by, you know, and out of here by 8 p.m., open at 10 a.m. every day.
In the last few days since the police and authorities reopened the street, what have you seen going on? I mean, it looks to me it's a memorial. There are a lot of folks coming and going still.
Well, if I look at it directly, it's still fenced off and it's become a crime zone. And I think there's still investigations that are going on that will probably continue to some degree. But I think there's still speculation as to what the destiny of Pulse will be. The owners are trying to reopen it. And of course, there's a lot of mixed feelings from the people who would have attended that, certainly. There are also thoughts of turning it into a memorial site or a portion of it into a memorial site. I mean, clearly it's a temporary memorial right now with all the balloons and the things that are hanging on the fence today.
What's it like for a business owner coming back to work after this terrible tragedy in the heart of Orlando and looking at this every day?
Well, it's tapered off to some extent right now. I mean, it was a media frenzy. I mean, day one, a week ago, Tuesday, when it was our first day of business. I mean, it was every bit, every news agency, you know, from national agencies, local agencies were here. There were interviews with a number of individuals and agencies and such. Things have tapered off a bit, but, you know, certainly there's an awareness of what happened over there. You know, and I heard there's a fund that's being started for the individuals who work there, which is great to hear. I mean, certainly those are the most affected.
Jonathan Toothman, a lot of businesses around here were closed down in the wider cordon in that first week, and that must have had a pretty big impact for this part of Downtown South.
No question. Downtown South is our main street and connects quite a few businesses together along this corridor, and it's been negatively affected. I mean, obviously there's businesses closed, we're out of business and can't do anything. Some have been able to operate in a different location, but some that own stores, like myself, you know, obviously you're just out of business.
How did it affect you financially?
Well, I mean, there's a 100% loss of revenue, you know, no revenue at all for 10 days. And so that has substantial effects. I mean, there's automated payments that come due regardless as to, you know, how much money's in the bank, right? There's payroll that has to get paid for the prior pay period. I was in a situation the Monday following, before we opened, that I had an auto draft occurred that I had to pull in a line of credit, you know. So, yeah, it's been negatively affected, but again, we're trying to rebound and get back to some sense of normalcy.
There's a lot of folks just coming here to kind of look at the nightclub, spectate, pay their respects, etc. What about just off the street business? Are you finding that in the week since you reopened, there's been more people coming through your doors?
I think it was pretty strong the first couple of days. I mean, no question. I mean, the outreach from the little press conference that was held at Raging Cajun, the bike shop, the Wednesday following, put a surge into it. You know, I think I've seen a lot of Facebook, you know, and a lot of customers. I certainly have seen an effect, a positive effect. But at this point, we haven't seen a drop in the people who are across the street looking and paying vigil to what had happened. I mean, it's a turnstile of people throughout every day. There's 10 or 12 or 15 or 30 people at any given time, mm-hmm. and they come and go all throughout the whole day and into the night. I mean, there's been times I drove by here at 9 or 9:30 just the other night, and there was still 30 people out there. So, but am I getting business from it? I don't think so. I don't think I'm getting a lot of people coming across from the incident.
So what's going on in terms of what support's been offered either from the Downtown South organization or from other entities?
Well, the state has provided an emergency bridge loan that's been made available. I've actually had to apply for that. I actually just got approved the other day, so it is very quick. I haven't received any funds yet, but I have gotten notice that there's an approval. I've not heard of any federal assistance at this point. There's a bridge loan, and then again, there's an SBA long-term loan that might be made available as well.
How many businesses do you think are going to have to apply for that, being a similar situation to you, having to pay employees during that 10 days or so when things were shut down?
Well, without question, Pulse is the most negatively affected. I mean, they have 30 or 40 employees there, and quite frankly, they obviously, I'm sure they need some sort of assistance, which I'm sure they're going to get from a different perspective. As far as myself and other businesses like mine, I got to believe there's going to be at least 8 or 10 businesses right here in this direct vicinity, the small businesses like myself that might need to be assisted to some degree with a bridge loan or an SBA.
I wonder if you could just talk a little bit, Jonathan Toothman, about, I guess, the emotional impact of this. I mean, having this happen literally steps from your front door, how's it affected you?
Well, it's incredible. I mean, you know, to realize what had happened over there that night is just, it's surreal. I mean, people lost their lives. I mean, this is going to be an event that Orlando will be known by, unfortunately. But again, what happened afterwards, too, the emotional outreach and the support, not only locally, but statewide and around the world, you hear things and people traveling in, is just almost as moving, you know, to see the support and just the interest and, you know, the kindness that's been extended by the people in the area.
Do you get the sense that we've seen the best of what Orlando has to offer in the days and weeks that have followed?
There's no question that there's been a very positive outreach and a surge of emotion amongst the entire community. And there's clear evidence that Orlando has really, really come to terms, or trying to come to terms with this emotionally, and I feel that Orlando has rebounded.
Do you feel like this sense of unity is going to persist months, years out from now?
Well, that's hard to say, you know, but certainly the hope is that it strengthens us all.
Jonathan Toothman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Just over a mile from the Radio Shack is the Beard Hall Senior Center, and on the third floor is a temporary business recovery center. Sarah Albadri is the executive director of the Downtown South Main Street program, and she wants to make sure businesses affected by the shooting can get the help they need to make up for that lost week.
The Main Street program is focused on creating a better business district in each one of the areas that they're in. And so for the Downtown South area following the Pulse shooting, what we really try to focus on was communications with our businesses and making sure they knew about what was happening with the road closure, all the efforts the city was making to see if they could open up the road following the investigation. And then following that, connecting with programs that are both state and federally based. So right now we have the U.S. Small Business Administration, as well as the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity. They have a business recovery center set up here in our district for businesses to be able to come in and find out more about the resources that are available to them.
There was a pretty wide cordon around the nightclub in that week after the shooting. How many businesses were closed down?
Sure. So the road closure covered the area between Miller, which is near Orlando Health, their main entrance, all the way to Michigan. That's about a little less than a mile, and 60 total businesses were directly impacted by that. 14 of them were closed for a total of 9 days.
And that's pretty big if you're a small business, right? I mean, that's, you know, more than a week of commerce out of your budget. That's got to be tough to cope with.
That's a tremendous impact. So 9 out of 30 days, that's about a third of your revenue for an entire month. Even the businesses that could open who had access through side streets, their access was so severely limited that, you know, even if you're open, you have 2 to 3 people coming in your door all day, which is tough to support your employees with.
So tell me about the folks who've come to you guys for assistance and what they've been asking for and how you've been able to help them out.
So for our businesses, what we're trying to provide to them is communication about what assistance is available through state and federal programs. The state of Florida is providing small emergency bridge loans, which are interest-free loans for 90 to 180 days. The U.S. Small Business Administration is providing long-term low-interest loans from about 4% interest for as long as 30 years. So we're hoping those businesses can take advantage of that. But for the most part, I think our businesses are just concerned about taking loans out on revenue they've never been able to collect. So they're just trying to figure out what that all looks like. On our end, we're just trying to advocate for our businesses as much as possible for potentially broader assistance available in the future.
Can you give me an idea of the kinds of loan values that people are looking for that people might have gotten so far?
Our businesses are still trying to pursue some of these loans. So I think it ranges anywhere from $7,000 to $25,000, which is the cap for what the state is offering. A lot of our businesses are looking at this as what's going to happen to their business long term and deciding whether this is a viable opportunity for them or not.
Pulse, of course, is the business that's the most effective. Have you guys been kind of chatting to them about how you can help that business?
We've been in touch with them. Obviously, they're dealing with a lot more than some of our other businesses, of course. So we've been in touch with them as much as possible. But I think for them, I think it's going to be a different situation for Pulse.
In the aftermath of this, you know, there has been a huge outpouring of support from all over the country, all over the world, in fact, and we've seen, you know, funds being raised for victims and victims' families. And then there's also this kind of intangible sense of Orlando has to stand together. Are you seeing some of that in a practical sense, in that people are stepping up and trying to support these local businesses around the area of Pulse?
I think that's what's so unique and beautiful about Orlando, is that all of these people have really rallied around every community that's been impacted by this, including our business community. Many of our businesses, for instance, Raging Cajun, Radio Shack, Pavlik Chiropractic, all these folks are seeing new faces in their door. What I'm more concerned about is what the long-term impact is, and maybe once the media fades, will our businesses see those same new customers?
And is that something that the city has to step up and help out with long term, or do you see the state playing more of a role there? Who do you see as the major players who can help out these businesses long term?
I think here locally, of course, the Downtown South Main Street program is going to do everything that we can to promote our businesses, but we're a very small and lean nonprofit organization. What we're looking for is to rally an army together around our businesses to make sure they're not only surviving this recovery, but continue on the trajectory they were on prior to this, was a thriving economic engine for the city of Orlando. So what we're looking for is partners in the city of Orlando, which they've been tremendous in helping us in every way that they can, but also the state, the local business community, really anybody who can come out and help us and spread the word about what's happening here and make sure that we stand up back up on our feet.
Have you been communicating with some other cities, other communities that have been affected by a shooting or a natural disaster?
So the Main Street program, Main Streets are all over the country as officially accredited programs, and we're one of those. What we did immediately following what happened at Pulse Monday morning, we reached out to every single one of the Main Streets around the country, and unfortunately, several of them have been victims of mass shootings. One story in particular that stands out is in Washington, D.C., following the Navy Yard shootings, Barracks Row, which is a Main Street program adjacent to that area, lost all but three of their businesses, not immediately, but within a year of the shooting. And so just figuring out, how do we make sure that doesn't happen here? What best practices can we learn from other cities around the country?
And just tell me a little bit about what's happening here at the Beardall Senior Center. You're about a mile from the site of the shooting. Does everybody in the downtown South Main Street area know that this is here and there are resources here, people they can talk to and get some advice on these things?
Yeah, so here at the Beardall Center, we've located local, regional, federal, and state resources so that businesses can come here and talk to staff. But we've also made sure to walk with the folks who are located here and canvas to each one of the businesses so that they know that this is available to them.
This is kind of a temporary arrangement, right? I mean, you've set up here on the third floor of the Beardall Senior Center. You're not going to be here forever, though.
So the Small Business Administration will be here through July 12th. The state's program will be available through the end of the month. The Downtown South Main Street program, though, has been here since 2008 and will continue to be here and serve as a resource for all of our businesses.
Are you confident that folks are going to pull through this business-wise, at least?
Certainly, that's our goal. I think the way that we've seen Orlando rally time and time again, and for sure this time, we really do believe that our community will come together, and I have strong faith in that.
Sarah El-Badri, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
We've been asking you to share your responses to the Pulse shooting on our website at Post Your Pulse, and you have pictures, songs, reflections, and poems. Here's Victor Rivera reading a poem he wrote and shared on our site.
Orlando, my city beautiful, has been through trouble and situation. As we rise from the strife, united we'll stand, like the forefathers of our nation. Transplants and immigrants from afar, and natives as well, we bear a scar. And each and every day we fought to define who we are. And now we've risen up to stand together, to love together. Orlando's true identity has finally become true, as the prisms of life have shined through. It's in the world of you and I. It's in the tears that we've all cried. It's in the love that we've shared. And it was in that moment that we cared. We found who we are. Orlando's our city. We are the soul and heart. And the club shooting tragedy forced our pulse to start. And we'll keep beating. We'll keep living. Like a river flowing, the city beautiful is like a flower growing. This is our time to be who we are. And now the world is knowing. Even through the right and the wrong, we'll always be Orlando strong.
That's Victor Rivera reading his poem. You can find more responses and share your own at our website, wmfe.org/postyourpulse. Still to come, what does Marco Rubio's re-election bid mean for other Senate and congressional candidates? Political analyst Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres join us when Intersection returns. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Marco Rubio decided last month that he wants to hold on to his Senate seat after all. So how does that change the equation for the other Senate candidates, both the high-profile contenders and some of those who aren't so well-known? And how is the fallout from the Pulse shooting filtering into state and national politics? Well, Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House lawmaker and now heads the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for having me.
So the qualifying deadline has come and gone for candidates running for Senate and House. You may have heard of some of the names in the Senate race, Marco Rubio, for example, but what about some of the other candidates? What should we know about them? Dick Batchelor, let me start with you. You know, we've got Marco Rubio, Patrick Murphy, Alan Grayson. These are people who have been in the headlines for one reason or another. Do other candidates even have a look in?
Probably not. I mean, Marco Rubio has been in the news for obvious reasons. The poor man's been running for President of the United States and saying that he would never serve in the United States Senate again. He was tired of it. And, of course, now he's announced that he's going to run for his seat again, United States Senate. Patrick Murphy has been raising a lot of money. He's been pressing a lot of people about, however, of late here, he's had some negative press about maybe fudging his credentials a little bit. Mm-hmm. Alan Grayson, of course, in the race. Alan has a capacity to raise money. He gets online, not unlike Bernie Sanders, and is able to raise quite a bit of money. But keep in mind, his personal net worth is $32 million. And the big question is, the million-dollar question, if I'm about to put it that way, is he prepared to dump some of that money in that race?
Mm-hmm. Do you see any of these other candidates getting any kind of leverage in this race at all?
No, I do not.
Frank Torres, Rubio getting in the race pretty late, but he's the sitting senator, was all over the country and the news late last year up until March campaigning for president. So how much latent kind of campaign awareness does he have? Does it matter that he's getting in so late?
You know, it doesn't. And, you know, while he wasn't strong enough to beat Donald Trump here in Florida, he still has legions of loyal supporters that really do like him, and they like him in the Senate. And compared to what was a lackluster field, when he jumped in, everybody just sort of cleared the way. There's only one challenger left, Carlos Baruff, and Marco Rubio is beating him by, I believe, 61 points in the polls. So, you know, he really is getting the GOP excited about their chances in the Senate again. So I don't think there's any fatigue, and I think he'll pick it back up where he left off relatively quickly.
But he's been on a little bit of a roller coaster ride. You know, he was mm-hmm. on the front of Time magazine as the savior of the Republican Party a couple of years ago, and then everybody thought he would be doing very well in a presidential campaign and back. But 95% of the incumbents really win re-election, and he'll have all the money he needs.
Does that paint a good picture then for Carlos Baruff if he's losing in the polls, Frank Torres? Does that matter? Do the polls count as much as they might have a few years ago?
You know, you can't always trust polls. They go up and down, they go up and down. But, you know, in this particular instance, I think you can because Carlos Baruff wasn't necessarily a clear frontrunner before Marco Rubio got in a race. But he too is very wealthy, and he's made major media buys here in Orlando. And his face is shown on television on a pretty regular basis.
And but he said he would spend $15 million of his own money.
Yeah, he's spent millions. But for to pull in single digits against Marco Rubio or low double digits, he's obviously not getting his money's worth because he's at a big disadvantage here against Rubio, the incumbent.
Would Rick Scott campaign for Baruff?
Rick Scott, his statement was that Carlos Baruff should get consideration along with Marco Rubio. Now, Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantero was in town and slammed those assumptions last week, saying that Rick Scott does not take a part in the primaries. So there's conflicted messaging right there. But right now, it seems that the establishment and a lot of supporters would be mostly behind Marco Rubio.
Now, there's a pretty long list of candidates there. Do any other names stick out to you?
You know, as far as competitors, not necessarily. There are some interesting third-party candidates that are currently slugging it out, you know, in the background but aren't registering in the polls. But at this point, it seems to be a three-candidate race.
We got one libertarian candidate. I think he said that everybody should do LSD and practice sorcery, so I don't know.
Which candidate is this? You're referring to Augustus Invictus?
Yes. An interesting candidate. And also, then I think he publicly said he killed a goat and drank the goat's blood or something. He's an interesting character. I'm not sure he's qualified to be U.S. Senator. But he's interesting.
What do you know about Augustus Invictus, Frank?
You know, I've spoken to him several times. You know, he is, he's admitted to taking part in a religious ritual where he sacrificed a goat and drank its blood. He's also been in talks over a mixed martial arts fight with another one of his opponents. And, you know, he is a very interesting personality in this race. But, yeah, you know, my readers, you know, he registers well with the readers. People are clicking on whatever he has to say. So, you know, while he is a long shot in the race, he definitely does add an interesting extra arena of activity to what is to the Senate race.
And the question, if he moves in the polls, I think the guidelines for Leadership Florida, which broadcasts the U.S. Senate debates, is 12.5%. So if you make 12.5% in the poll, you could be on the stage. So it'll be interesting to see if he, just even not being known, can register that many independent votes.
Dick Batchelor, is Florida a friendly state for libertarians?
I don't particularly think so. I mean, the Tea Partiers, and you've got to dissect between the Tea Partiers and the Libertarians, but I don't think necessarily. I think you see most Libertarians tending to go toward the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. What about this candidate, Rocky De La Fuente? He was running for president in the Democratic primary. Now he's running for Senate here. Do you know much about him, Dick Batchelor?
I don't know one word about him.
You know, you've seen him, Kim. I've seen his campaign out there sort of making a presence for himself. But no, he really isn't really registering on anybody's radar at this point either. And, you know, you have these tourism candidates, because running for office is fun, you know, if you really, if you come into it with the right mindset. And I think you could have that in this case right here.
Dick Batchelor, let's talk a little bit more about Patrick Murphy. You referred to some kind of concerns or suggestions that he'd inflated his resume. There was that reporting there. What did Marco Rubio's entry into the race, though, do for Patrick Murphy's chances?
Well, I mean, all I'll just set it back. I mean, again, as we said, when you're the incumbent United States Senator, you can have almost unlimited assets as far as campaign contributions that put you out front. It's an interesting race because you've got, you know, the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate, Harry Reid, saying to Alan Grayson, I don't want you. You should go away. You should be defeated. You got the president and the vice president endorsing Murphy. But he has had some bad press. Apparently, allegedly, he's inflated his business credentials. He wasn't really not a CPA. He wasn't a small business owner. So those things come back and bite you. And it really depends, again, in that primary, how much money Alan Grayson is willing to spend of his own net worth.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Frank Torres? Does it look good for Alan Grayson right now?
You know, Patrick Murphy does have all those endorsements that Dick just mentioned and the strong backing from the establishment, but the two leapfrog in the polls. Patrick Murphy hasn't been able to extend a consecutive streak of victories in the polls, so it's still very much in play. And Alan Grayson has always been sort of that outsider, anti-establishment Democratic candidate anyways. So it's really going to be fun when these two finally get on a debate stage away from all the other background noise and finally just have at it in front of the Democratic voters of Florida.
Is there anybody else you'd like to see debate, like maybe Carlos Baruff versus Alan Grayson? Would that be an entertaining debate?
You know, there has been one inter-party debate so far. You'll recall Alan Grayson debated David Jolly, who was now out of the race and running for Congress.
That was a very polite affair.
Yes, it was a very polite affair.
I think the Republicans were upset because he was agreeing with Alan Grayson so much.
Yeah, and you know, the two parties agreed for it to be a cordial affair. Could we see another inter-party a debate like that. Alan Grace has done it once. He could do it against Carlos Baruff, but I don't think it would be as cordial this time given the two sharp differences on the issues.
Well, let's pivot to the congressional races. The Marco Rubio re-entrance triggered a bit of a reshuffle on the Republican side. Carlos Lopez Cantero dropping out of that Senate race. David Jolly jumping back into his congressional district. Dick Batchelor, let me talk to you about Charlie Crist. What do Charlie Crist's chances look like now? Jolly is back campaigning for the seat he holds currently.
I think Charlie Crist, the thing he's got, obviously, name recognition. When you've been Attorney General, Commissioner of Education, you know, Governor, U.S. Senate candidate, now you've run for everything there is to run for, so he's got the name recognition. And I think he has advantage. That district tends to be a little bit Democratic in there, so mm-hmm. I think he has an advantage in that race.
Frank Torres, David Jolly, is that a smart move for him, getting out of that race, of course, and then getting back into the district he now holds?
You know, it really was the only move David Jolly had left after Marco Rubio got back in the race. And, you know, after redistricting, the numbers don't look good for him in that. He's going to be the underdog against Charlie Crist. Is it a completely hopeless situation? No, but it will definitely be the uphill climb, and he is definitely the underdog in that contest against the former governor.
How would you rate David Jolly as far as kind of conservative credentials? Is he a fairly moderate Republican?
He is a fairly moderate Republican. I would venture to say he was probably the most moderate that was in the Republican primary up until most of the field dissolved after Marco Rubio got back in. So, you know, he does have some left-leaning issues, and that could help him in a race against Charlie Crist during a presidential election.
Dick Batchelor, I see you nodding your head there. Do you see David Jolly winning over some Democrats in that race?
I really don't know. I mean, he has some moderate positions on some issues, but the fact is that Chris has staked out his ground here. He's got the name recognition par excellence, so I just don't know how he can overcome that.
Chris, though, has a bit of baggage. You know, he lost the governor's race. Mm-hmm. He was accused of flip-flopping on a lot of things, and that seemed to stick when Rick Scott was running against him. Mm-hmm. Is that to his discredit this time as well?
No, and I think the same thing. He'll use that same kind of attack against Jolly, too, that he's flip-flopped on some of the issues, too. So it's kind of that breaks even, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, let's talk about Congressional District 10. It's shaping up as a fairly tough race for Democrats. Just remind us what happened, though, with Dan Webster and what part redistricting placed with shaping this race.
Well, after the Florida courts decided to redraw all of the districts in the state earlier this year, Congressman Daniel Webster, who currently represents the 10th District, found himself in an area where a seat that had been a fairly safe Republican was now certainly strongly Democrat. So re-election was a long shot for him. So he decided to run in the District 11 part of the state, which is a neighboring district and does overlap certain parts of the area he already represents. So he finds himself there, which opens up his current seat in the 10th District.
Do you see him doing well in that district, District 11? Is Dan Webster going to be around with us for some time to come in this capacity?
Yeah, he's certainly the favorite because not only does he have his time in Congress, he was in Tallahassee for decades and well-regarded by both parties. So you're running against one of the most well-liked figures in Florida politics if you're running against Daniel Webster. So I think he should do very, very well in the 11th district.
Dick Batchelor, there's a slew of high-profile Democratic candidates running in this district. To talk us through some of these names, you've got Geraldine Thompson, Val Demings, Bob Poe, Fatima Fahmy.
Well, if you look at this interesting race, because Val Demings, who's running in this district, almost beat Dan Webster 2 years ago. She's the former police chief of Orlando, the first female police chief, the first African-American police chief. So she has a lot of credentials. She's very well recognized. By the same token, Senator Geraldine Thompson, she's served in the House, she's served in the Florida Senate. She's a very good member of the Florida Senate. She got name recognition in that district, and that district's about 40%, 42% African-American, I believe. So they might split the vote. I don't know. Bob Poe is a former chairman of the Democratic Party, a self-made millionaire. He's put $1.3 million of all money in and said he will match dollar for dollar any other money that comes into other campaigns, so he's prepared to spend his net worth to get there. Fatima is a newcomer, no money, woefully underfunded, I should say, and so she's not getting very much traction.
Is there an issue, though, a problem for the Democratic Party in kind of concentrating a lot of their fairly high-profile candidates in one race? And we're seeing this in some other districts, too.
Yeah, I would like to see these candidates split up and go in some other races because you've got very qualified candidates in this race, and it's a bit top-heavy with the credentials.
Is this the kind of conversation that goes on in the Democratic Party behind the scenes? Do they try and kind of persuade some candidates to run in different districts?
You're assuming Democrats can organize anything. The answer is no, it's not.
Frank Torres, you moderated a debate fairly recently with these folks. What stood out for you about that debate?
You know, most of it was gun control revolving around the recent attacks at the Pulse nightclub. All four of the Democratic candidates support a ban on assault weapons. All of them support measures that would prohibit persons on the no-fly, no-buy list or the FBI watch list from buying weapons. And, you know, and all of them would have participated in the congressional sit-in over gun control that recently took place in Washington. They all share a lot of the same platforms. What they seem to be using to differentiate themselves is their background. And I think the one who can best do that will have the advantage heading into the final weeks of the primary.
And one thing that's very notable, though, you know, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee usually does not get involved in primaries, but they have gotten involved. The chairman of that committee has come down on behalf of Val Demings. Nancy Pelosi loves Val Demings and has been down fundraising for her, too. So it's really interesting that they would take a position in the primary, particularly when you got somebody like Bob Poe, who's the former chairman of the Florida Democratic Party, and somebody mm-hmm. like Senator Johnny Thompson, who's a very loyal Democrat, having served in the House and Senate. So it's really very interesting to me, and I'm intrigued by the fact that the DCCC has gotten in a race involved in the primary.
Mm-hmm. So that's unusual?
It is unusual.
I'm wondering, too, Frank, I mean, you talk about gun control and how the recent, tragic incident at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando has kind of cast a pall over this particular race. Do you see that happening in other races, too, like, for example, in the Senate races?
Yeah, I think it'll certainly have a role in the Senate race. And because of where we are in the heart of the I-4 corridor, it'll have a role in the presidential race. You know, people will point to Orlando and will either identify it as a place where current gun control measures went wrong or a place where current national security measures went wrong. And each party will try to use the tragedy that happened here for leverage to help their own campaign cause. It'll be a very personal political discussion for people here in Central Florida.
Are you seeing some of that too, Dick Batcher? I mean, for example, in the Senate race, we might see more of those conversations about national security. Who do you think might have a bit of an advantage here?
You know, I think I'm going to say this. Each candidate has the advantage to the extent it's on top of everybody's agenda. In fact, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, is going to bring some legislation to the floor, you know, this coming week. And so you got the Republicans trying to find an out on this. You know, it's going to be maybe it's not legislation the Democrats can support, but at least they're engaged in the conversation. But I think you'll see something that will come out. But that bodes well, probably better for the Democrats than it does Republicans. But the Republicans finally see that 90% of Republicans polled definitely want background checks, so you find a lot of Republican support, notwithstanding the position and the power of the NRA.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House lawmaker, head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also joined by Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Benoit Glazer started hosting concerts at his house more than 15 years ago. And since then, the Timucua White House has become a staple of the Orlando music and art scene. But earlier this year, there were fears it could be shut down over a permitting issue. We'll talk about what's ahead for the iconic concert venue when Intersection returns. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Artists and musicians have been beating a path to the door of the Timucua White House since 2000. But last year, it looked like the unconventional performance venue might have to close its doors over a permitting issue. Well, Benoit Glazer runs the Timucua White House in Orlando. He's also the music director for the Cirque du Soleil La Nuba at Disney. Benoit Glazer, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the White House. The city asked you to get a permit for the White House. This was some time ago. Now everything's official. Performances are underway again. Did you have to stop for a while, though, as you sorted things out?
No. We kept going. You know, we took 2 weeks off to maintain the piano. We do that every year in May to do maintenance on a piano. But no, we didn't stop. It was an adventure. It's actually not all done. Like, there's a final approval because now the parking agreement is done. So I just have to deliver that and the security deposit and proof of insurance and all that stuff. So
when does that happen?
The final committee meeting to approve that is July 25th.
Okay, so you got a bit of time. Have you been getting more interest in performances at the White House while this permit issue was kind of hanging over the venue? Because there's been quite a bit of publicity around it.
No, it hasn't changed much, really. I mean, I got a steady influx of requests to be on the email list. And memberships are going well. But as far as performances, I'm booked far enough ahead of time, you know, has really little impact on that.
Just remind me the kinds of artists and performers that you reach out to or that who want to play at the White House.
Yeah, sure. It's a mix. It's on purpose. It's a mix of local musicians, even amateur musicians, and, you know, world-class, you know, musicians from all over the world, Japan, Europe, New York City, you know, and Africa and Asia, actually.
Do they find out about you or does it work the other way? Do you reach out to them?
I haven't reached out to anybody for 10 years now. it all happens pretty much on its own. And as a matter of fact, we just put together a programming committee yesterday because I have so many requests and I have to start saying no, you know, and I'm not too good at that. So we put a committee together to make sure that we have a good balance of everything. Like, you know, our whole adventure is about balance. It's finding a new balance between the performers and the audience. Concert halls, I have a specific, I want to say maybe a power imbalance, if you will, if between the stage and the audience. The other, it's kind of usually passive and all the power is on stage. And then you get the other end of the spectrum, the smaller venues, the bars and things where all the power lies in the audience and the performers sometimes are stuck, you know, trying to cover glass noise and stuff like that. So
what kind of balance are you looking for? Do you want some kind of interaction with the audience? Do you want people to be kind of yelling out or anything? Or are you
it's not about that necessarily, but it's about, you know, first of all, providing a good experience for the performers and providing a good experience for the audience. And what we've found when you think, you know, usually venues, are there to make money. And so they're interested in the audience's experience and they care very little about the performer's, you know, experience. And we're not like that. I'm a performer and so I know what it's like to, play in a place like, you know, we offer a nice acoustic space, a good mm-hmm. recording, you know, the four camera shoot and all that stuff. And, a certain level of maybe camaraderie, you know, between the venue, quote unquote, and the performers. And then we also provide a nice audience for the performers. And then, of course, we offer the audience a nice performance for free. And so all in all, you know, it's worked very well so far.
Benoit Glazer, what makes a good audience from your point of view? What do you look for in an audience?
It has to be a good match between what the performance is going to be and what the audience expect that performance to be. And so that's where our strength lies because we have, you know, 3,000 people on the email list, but only 125 seats in the venue, which means that people only come to the things they really want to see. I have a few people, a few regulars who don't even look at what it is and they come to everything because they want to learn and explore new things that they don't know they might like or not like. Mm-hmm. But in either way, our audience has proven over the years, you know, there's always exceptions and things, but over the years overall, our audience always seems to be well matched with the performance. And that's, you know, that's a good feeling when people are there to listen and they participate when it's time to participate. And, you know, and the performers, you know, when we have folk performers or whatever and they have the audience participate, they're always amazed at the quality of what they get in return because, you know, we have opera singers in the audience and a lot of musicians and artists in the audience. And so our audience is a little notch above the normal or average audience that people get. And so it counts, you know, all of this adds up to the experience of everyone.
So you're saying you get some pretty classy sing-alongs.
Oh, you're right.
It's kind of a small venue too. So from a performer's point of view, can that be intimidating at times, being that close to the audience, having all those eyeballs on you?
You know, I can vouch for that. I mean, I remember, you know, Christopher Wilkins, the former conductor of the OPU, I had to move my trumpet if I did, you know, when I emptied my horn so that...
The spit
wouldn't fall on his pant leg, you know, so that was pretty close. That was a little intimidating. But I think that most of our performers are used to small venues. Usually, I mean, you know, The only people I've consistently said no to are, you know, really pop things where the music is a product and not an artistic endeavor. And so those people might be used to playing big, you know, bigger venues, and they could be intimidated by that. But, you know, all our people are classical performers, jazz performers, folk performers. They're used to small venues, you know, of all kinds.
How do you decide whether something's too pop to be, you know, suitable, though? Because that's a bit of a judgment call, right?
It is. But basically, if I figure if they don't need me, then it's, you know what I mean? It's that's when I would say no. If I don't need them, like in other words, it kind of happens on its own, because if somebody might play, you know, somebody's asked me to play at the house, they played at the Amway or Bob Carr, whatever. They don't need me, and the audience doesn't need them to see them in the house, because they've seen them in these big venues. They can see them in the big. So, you know, that is kind of a clear cut case of, well, you know, let's not do that. I mean, if, you know, Sting wanted to come at the house and do something really different because he's trying something, or because, you know, I wouldn't say no to that, because it's not going to be a pop thing, even though he's a very popular, you know, artist, or he's like a very, very well-known artist. We have very well-known people who come, but they don't come to do their normal pop thing where it's a product. That's where the emphasis is of that. So we're trying to, we, you know, nothing we do, like even the visual artist, like if it looks like if it's a product, I don't do it, and I'm not interested. And normally they're not interested in what we have to offer either. So, but the art usually is there, and it dictates what should come on and not. And it's always happened organically, and it's very easy.
Who have you turned down?
A couple of people, but I won't mention names. But they just, you know, they didn't need me, and frankly, I didn't need them. Like, you know, it was clear to me.
So the Timucua Art House is a place where you can hear things that you might not get to hear anywhere else.
That you probably will not get to hear anywhere else. I mean, not that it's necessarily the case, but most often it's the case. So, you know, Peter Brutzmann is a good example, German free jazz saxophone player. He's in his 60s, I guess, now, maybe his 70s. And he chooses to come at the house. And he also chooses not to play anywhere else in the Southeast when he comes to the United States, because he's found the house now and he's happy with the experience he gets. And he told his agent, I don't want to play anywhere else. So we get him. And then in return, you know, he gets a great audience.
Are there any restrictions that you now have to put on the performances under this new conditional use permit? Or are you just doing whatever you were doing before?
Yeah, it's the conditional permit, it's been, like I said, it's been an adventure. I learned a lot about red tape and things like that. But, you know, I always try to see the good thing. The good thing is that now everything we do is official and nobody can say, hey, you can't do that. So that's the good thing. Now we can just keep doing what we have been doing. The flip side of that is now we, you know, it's kind of put the brakes on some special projects we had, future projects we had. So I have to approach those projects with the from a different angle, and I will do that. And I'm sure it's going to happen anyways. It's just that I can't approach it via the technocrat or bureaucrat route. You know, I have to go more the political route, which I will do that.
What are those projects?
Well, we had expansion projects, which I understand we may or may not happen, but eventually, you know, we have a boat project. That's a special project. But the offshoot of that was turning the house eventually into a residence for young musicians and artists, because the house is not only the performance space, it's a house, and we have 7 bedrooms in the house. And so we could, you know, we could house young artists post-school, you know, early in their careers in different disciplines, and put these people together and say, okay, you have to create like a weekly night of shows, you know, or events, like some, you have to create something and, you know, give it to the public on Thursday nights, whatever, and keep the Sunday nights concerts going, and give time to the Boone High School kids, you know, things like that. So because the Boone High School is right across the street. And so I wanted to create this new way of this new cauldron of creativity. And I know, because there's nothing like that anywhere in the Southeast United States, that it would attract talents from all over the world. And so it would be great for the city. So I'm going to keep plugging on that project. It's just I have to do it, you know, it has to come from above the people that I've dealt with. You know, the other side of this experience is the money, because, you know, it's the permit costs money, mm-hmm. and we had to get extra liability insurance, which costs money, and then they want a security deposit for the parking lot. You know, so that's all money. And, you know, for them, it's peanuts. I'm sure they never thought about it twice. But for us, it's like 9% of my annual budget. So I have to raise more money, you know, to pay for that. But we will. And because, and in fact, the new conditional use permit will help us raise money, because now everything is on the up and up, and mm-hmm. everything is official. And so it's good. It's all good.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking to Benoit Glazer, who runs the Timucua White House in Orlando. Benoit, you said before also you want to step aside from the management of the White House at some point. Am I
well,
right on that?
Not the White House. I've been working very hard with Christopher Belt, who is the founder and director of the Accidental Music Festival, and he's a young guy. He's really an inspiration to me. He started that Accidental Music Festival. I think he was like 21 or 20, you know, 21, maybe 22 years old, early 20s. It's incredible what he's done. He's brought mm-hmm. in like a full symphony orchestra from Mexico and some, you know.
What is the Accidental Music Festival?
The Accidental
Where
Music,
is it?
It's one of the organizations that we collaborate with, and it's a lot of it happens at the house, but other places too, Plaza Live, Avalon Gallery, you know, the museum, Orlando Museum of Art. Like, he uses different venues, but it's all about new classical music, so new, usually chamber music, but it's also, you know, Deerhoof and, you know, underground kind of. So basically, he's working on attracting a new audience to new music, and he's also helping to develop new music per se, so like the actual music. And so, and basically what we're trying to do as a board, you know, my board and I, is not the house. I'm always going to be involved with the house. Actually, we want to not limit my activities, but I want to concentrate more on the house and less on the rest of the foundation, because we have an education branch. We have, you know, all kinds of facets to our mission. And so other people, I'm starting to delegate some mm-hmm. of the things.
And you know, and you have a day job too, we should point out.
Yes, I do. I do. And a hobby. Because the concerts, you know, used to be my hobby, but yeah, now it's a full-time job. So now I started playing golf because I need
oh, really? That's what you do to wind down?
Yeah, that's what I do to wind down. So on top of, you know, I'm a trumpet player, so whether I'm working or not, I have to keep practicing my instrument. And so that's always my day is usually pretty well spent.
What do we got to look forward to over the summer, Benoit Glazer?
We have many great events coming up. A pretty steady mix of jazz, classical, folk. And basically, that's what my calendar says. You know, that's how people book themselves. Basically, they just look at the calendar, says open for jazz, the next week open for classical, next week open for folk, next week open for anything. That means theater, you know, book readings, music of any kind, whatever. And so, you know, basically we're booked. I just opened 2017 just a couple months ago, because I wanted to be sure that everything would work out with the permit and everything. But now, since we've known that it's going to work, then I've opened 2017, and we're booked all the way to Labor Day now, solid 2017. So it's moving pretty quickly.
Benoit Glazer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Thank you.